Thank you very much. Thank you, Sir Michael, and thank you, Saul, for that generous introduction. I was, of course, extremely flattered to be invited to give this lecture at my old alma mater. It is a true honor. But to be quite frank, I was also a little worried. I was not exactly sure what the founding historian's lecture was supposed to be. How heavy was it supposed to be? Was I supposed to display after-dinner skills? Or in this case, before dinner skills, and would I indeed get dinner if I didn't perform well? How witty could one be about liberalism and empire? And I Googled jokes about liberalism and empire and as part of my worrying about this talk, and of course, as you can imagine, precious little came up. Liberalism and empire, it seems, are no laughing matter. Liberalism certainly isn't. It's regarded as too pitiable or lamentable to be worthy of any robust humor. And you all know, I'm sure, why the sun was supposed never to set on the British Empire. It was because God would never trust a Britisher in the dark. So, and of course, my unease has been increased by the fact that a very important vote has just taken place in the House of Commons on the future of higher education in Britain. And I'm sure many minds are likely to be elsewhere. Saul did give me some advice, however, when I asked him, well, what's this supposed to be about? What's the tone supposed to be? He said, something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue will be suitable. The new and the borrowed bits will become evident later on. Let me start with the old and sometimes blue bits, namely me. It would be remiss of me not to take this occasion to pay tribute to the education I got here as an undergraduate, especially. I'm talking about the world that is truly old, I know that, but one's seldom given the opportunity to pay public tribute to the educational opportunities that were formative in one's life. And Sussex undergraduate experience was perhaps the most important experience, single experience of my life. There were many reasons for this. Three stand out. First, the intensity of the experience. 5 or 6 books a week, 2 stimulating tutorials, 2 essays. Second, the lesson of interdisciplinarity, a lesson of different kind of interdisciplinarity that we practice today, but nevertheless quite unusual in its day, and one that's continued to inform my sense of history. And thirdly, outstanding teachers, Ranajit Guha, Beryl Williams, I'm delighted to see here, Rod Kedwood, and Asa Briggs, and I'm really sorry that they can't be here. Rod Kedwood first taught me the importance of critical thinking. Asa Briggs, the galloping professor, as he was once titled by a Sunday color supplement magazine, whose example of scholarly accomplishment, public service, and commitment to his phrase, redrawing the boundaries of knowledge, set standards of professional achievement which remain an inspiration. It's perhaps not surprising that at times I think this is all a dream from which I shall awake and find that I really am delivering the founding historian's lecture at Sussex. But enough about me, let's turn to the business at hand. It was a major conceit of the British in the 19th and 20th centuries that their empire was a liberal empire. By this they meant that their imperial rule was more humane than others, that its mission was to bring a progressive modernity to, in Kipling's words, lesser breeds without the law. This was a view that not only underlay popular justifications of empire, it was a view that permeated the historiography. I'm not concerned to refute or to endorse that notion. I am, however, interested in the conception of a liberal empire itself and of the attempts to make it a reality. I'm concerned with how liberal society imagines it can reconcile its commitment to the rule of law, to freedom and democracy, with the realities of being an imperial power. And I'm intrigued by the historical question of how, by what social, rhetorical, and political cultural mechanisms, the commitment to empire is explained and processed within the culture of a liberal society. Now, the question of the relationship between liberalism and empire is one that has recently gained the attention of scholars and others, and it's not surprising that this is so. The issue of how liberal states accommodate imperial enterprise has been thrust before us by the recent history of the United States. But of course, these questions are hardly peculiar to the early 21st century. They were confronted by the British Empire as it rose to its period of hegemonic power in the early 19th century. And our renewed attention to it perhaps reflects the old adage about writing our history through our present-day concerns. I think this particular maxim, incidentally, is well illustrated by the current writing on liberalism and empire, by the writing by historians and by political scientists. The dominant theme of this scholarship is how liberalism inevitably betrays itself for empire. But that's not what I want to do today. In fact, I want to push the connection in a slightly different direction. I want to take the idea of a liberal empire seriously, at face value, for a change. And I'd like to explain how I came to that position. I got interested in this question as I was researching and writing the book that Saul mentioned a few moments ago, Making Empire. In that book, I spent quite a lot of time talking about how the missionary community in southern Africa in the early 19th century responded to racial difference. Of course, the broad outlines of the story will not surprise you. Most missionaries were ultimately unable to hold on to their original belief in a universal humanity and ended up racializing the Africans they encountered. But what really struck me about these missionaries was the power of their humanitarian ideals, a power which actually infused the imperial project as a whole in the early 19th century. And against my instincts, not to speak of my record as a committed materialist historian, I came away convinced that liberal humanitarianism had to be treated as authentic and a real ideology. So once Making Empire was done, I found myself thinking a lot about the problems of liberalism and empire. And when I received the invitation to speak in this series, I thought, what better place to try out these ideas in front, perhaps, of some of my old tutors and professors. So that is my subject for today. Briefly put, I shall argue that the idea of a liberal empire was at the center of imperial discourse and policy in Britain in the period 1820 to 1850. A liberal empire was imagined as an empire of human rights, an empire that rested on an empathetic understanding of indigenous peoples and cultures. It was a vision that found expression in policy, not only at the center of empire, but also at the frontier. The efforts, those policy efforts, however, were fraught and contradictory. No great surprise there. The reasons for this, however, go beyond the inherent contradictions of liberalism as a philosophy and have to do with the complexities of the encounter with indigenes. But the historical moment of the liberal empire in Britain left residues and legacies in the societies that it touched, which were of enduring historical significance. So in that way, too, I think the idea of liberal empire in this period needs to be taken seriously. I want to start with the tale of two men. The first is Edward John Eyre. Now, I'm sure many of you know, Edward Eyre is famous for one thing. As governor of Jamaica, he was responsible for one of the most notorious atrocities in the history of the British Empire. In response to a riot in 1865, he declared martial law, judicially murdered George Gordon, a leading Jamaican mulatto politician, and killing of nearly 500 others. But in the 1840s, Eyre presented a different face to the world, the face of the humanitarian liberal. In 1845, he published a two-volume book on the impact of white settlement in Australia. It was a book that highlighted and deplored the aggressions of the whites against the Aborigines. It argued for their dignity as human beings. It accorded Aboriginal culture a respect and recognition. For over 250 pages, it provided a detailed and sympathetic account of the ethnography of Aboriginal society. It proposed a renewed and an equitable attempt, a more equitable and liberal system of reforming Aboriginal society than we have yet attempted. It projected a humanitarian sensibility and provided a sustained argument for a policy that recognised the human rights of these people. Eyre had made his reputation as an explorer of the Australian outback. On one of those trips, he woke up one morning to discover that his sole white companion had been murdered by two of the three Aborigines who accompanied them. What's interesting about this, however, is that the event was described by Eyre without racial rancor, without moralizing. It is explained as a matter of fact, as a tragedy, as a result of the Aborigines' unease at being so far from their own society that they had, or from their own territory, that they decided to abscond, were surprised by the companion, and surprised by the companion in the act of stealing goods, and killed. That's Edward Eyre. Now the second man. He's a less familiar name. Well, there's Eyre on expedition. He's a less familiar name, although at the time he was a more important and famous man than Eyre. I speak of Sir George Grey. Grey in his day was a leading and commanding figure. He was the leading imperial administrator of the mid-19th century. He was a favorite of the Aboriginal Protection Society, who for a long time was held in high regard by the Colonial Office. He wrote memos on policy towards the Aborigines that were considered important enough to be circulated by the Colonial Office to other governors for their guidance. He served as a governor in South Australia. He was twice governor in New Zealand and twice in the Cape Colony. He was a colleague and superior of Eyre in Australia and New Zealand. Like Eyre, Grey also wrote a multi-volume book about his experiences as an explorer in Western Australia. His book also sympathetically portrayed Aboriginal society as it faced the dreadful onslaughts from white settlers. Like Eyre, he too had a violent encounter with Aborigines, which he recounts with a humanitarian empathy. These experiences as a young man triggered in Grey a lifelong interest in ethnography and an understanding of the complexity of cultures of supposedly savage people. He published the first vocabulary of South Australian Aboriginal dialects. He sponsored the first compilations of Maori history and folklore. He was the first governor of the Cape of Good Hope to learn Xhosa. He supported long-term research into the languages of the San and Khoi peoples, which later morphed into the modern anthropological studies of those groups. But like Eyre, there was a darker side to Grey. He was a skilled agent of imperial dispossession. He may have been guilty of the judicial murder of a Maori chief. He was certainly guilty of railroading the Xhosa chiefs in the late 1850s, packing them off to Robben Island. He efficiently and ruthlessly dispossessed the Xhosa of their land. He tamed and subordinated the Maori. Grey thus epitomized the main narrative of liberal empire. He encompassed the empire of the liberal humanitarian and the empire of atrocity. What interested me about Grey, however, were the mental processes that were played out as he moved between the implementer of liberal values and the destroyer of worlds. How were the competing tensions and moralities that were rattling around in his head, how were they reconciled? He was self-conscious enough to know that he had to match his evangelical liberal beliefs with his despotic and illiberal actions. And in the memos that he wrote, for example, explaining why he was sending the Xhosa chiefs to Robben Island, he can be seen struggling with himself to get this right, to get his story straight. Let us call it his conscience that he was working to square. It matters not. For me, it was a small window into the subjective processes that were involved in the reconciliation between liberalism and empire. So how do we explain what happened to Grey and Eyre? What are the historical mechanisms that describe and explain their transition from caring humanitarians to indifferent, indeed hostile, despots? What were the subjectivities that run through these shifts? The current literature on liberalism on empire and empire, the relationship between liberalism and empire, is of really limited help in answering these questions. We tend to gaze at 19th century liberals through the enormous condescension of 20th century political sensibilities. Liberalism is conceived, conventionally viewed, as being in an unholy copulation with empire. And a bulky literature has grown up, which has traced the original compact between liberalism and empire back to Locke himself, back to the founding father of liberalism. It's true that political theorists have demonstrated the nuances and intricacies of that relationship, but they've been less helpful in providing us ways of doing the history. In historical practice, liberalism and empire are viewed as actors in a morality play whose plot unfolds as a hypocritical teleology, whose narrative is contained within the ideological constraints that were laid down by Locke and then elaborated by liberalism's 19th century villains. If there's one absence that characterizes the scholarship on liberalism and empire, it is precisely the failure to pay attention to the socio-historical contexts and constructs. We need to apply the check of historical context. It's easy to see the heir of 1865, the heir who massacred led to the massacre of 500 Jamaicans. It's easy to see that man as implicit in the man of 1830, just waiting to reveal his authentic self. And the same is true of Gray. But if we do that, then what do we make of what they did and what they believed and what they tried to accomplish in 1840? How do we assess it? I don't think it's helpful for us to see their later careers as implicit in the logic of their earlier humanitarian beliefs. We need to get behind the evidence as historians, behind the evidence as well as in front of it. And that means taking seriously the empathy about racial difference that Eyre and Gray were trying to achieve in the 1830s and 1840s, and taking seriously also their aspiration to combine different cultures and belief systems in one civil polity. Let me give you an example of what I mean here. In 1841, Gray was a new governor of South Australia. He was trying to get a messy situation in the colony under control. And in June of that year, he wrote a memo giving his thoughts on the law and Aborigines. It's the kind of document that I've sort of learnt to be on the lookout for because it's introspection. It has an introspective quality to it, which provides, I think, a momentary window into the mentalité of the liberal imperialist and the creative search for alternative policies. It's a memo which is a rumination on how to find suitable methods of punishment for uncivilized people. Gray argued that it's unreasonable for us to apply our standards of crime and punishment to these uncivilized peoples. Their cultural experience, their mores have no bearing on our expectations, he argued. If the purpose of punishment is to, or was to, encourage reformation and deterrence, then those differences, those cultural differences, needed to be taken into account. And he argued that capital punishment does no good, since the Aboriginal view of death is not filled with the horror that it has for Western peoples. Imprisonment, however, is another matter. So Gray concludes that punishment policy needs to be constructed around these cultural distinctions, and it's for this reason, he argued, that he'd forbidden military expeditions to punish Aborigines for stock theft or other collective actions directed against the settlers, since this merely made racial tensions worse without having any reforming and deterring effects. Now, I know there's a lot one could say about what Gray is arguing here or what he's purveying, but for me it captures the dilemma of how to read the evidence of liberal empire. If we place ourselves behind the evidence, we have to see it as an attempt to reconcile cultural and racial difference and therefore to create a liberal imperial policy. If we put ourselves in front of the evidence, we can easily see where it's going to go or where it can go. That is, in the direction of a thoughtless dehumanization of the Aborigines. They don't feel pain like we do. If we do kill them, they hardly notice. For the moment, let's stay behind the evidence and consider briefly the policies that epitomized liberal empire. What was the content to this vision of liberal empire? What did it look like to those who thought it possible? Well, the place we have to start is one that is both obvious and fundamental, because this period that I'm talking about was a period that used to be called the Empire of Free Trade, but which is more appropriate to label it the Empire of Dispossession. It's not just that an enormous amount of territory was added to the British Empire after 1820. The central point is what happened in those territories. In the world dominated by English-speaking settlers, vast acts of dispossession of native peoples occurred, and colonial state structures of law and politics were installed. And for me, this frames the main agenda of research into the question of liberal empire. How did it work to extend its reach over indigenous peoples? There was no particular contradiction in the historical convergence of dispossession in the context of liberal political societies. Liberalism at this point was a crusading doctrine, both at home and abroad, but it was also a doctrine that was acutely sensitive to the hazards of the crusading mentality. The policies of a liberal empire were devised precisely to address some of the problems associated with the dispossession that was in full flood by 1820s. Those problems were threefold, and they were interrelated. There was the problem of racial cooperation. There was the problem of the land itself, of how to manage the question of land ownership. And finally, there was the character of the political structures that were constructed to regulate these societies, which included structures of political representation, but most crucially for my purposes, the processes of law. The empire imagined by liberal imperialists was an empire in which racial difference and human rights would be honored. There was a considerable discussion around the issue of racial difference within the context of empire and how human rights of indigenous peoples could be respected. Such debates represented an attempt to deal creatively with the question of racial difference and to find ways of reconciling diverse cultures within the context of the dynamic modernizing forces of British civilization. Liberal thought in the early 19th century did not see the reconciliation of indigenous culture with the forces of Western modernity as the problematic pairing that it subsequently became. Indeed, this reconciliation was not only seen as a moral imperative, it was seen as a lesson to be learned from earlier history. It was a lesson that was believed to be confirmed by the experience of history. Many of those who believed in such a project had direct experience of life in the colonies. They fully realized how violence and conquest were a powerful theme in empire and in imperial affairs. But they wanted to give due weight also to the tradition of seeking justice and fair treatment for indigenes in the British experience. Furthermore, in the 1830s, there were grounds for thinking that this particular historical moment was ripe for such a project. After all, the moral cause of abolitionism had finally triumphed, and the next step was surely seen as a set of policies to create racial harmony in the empire. The humanitarian lobby in British politics had successfully manipulated a select committee on Aboriginal tribes that reported in 1837 and established the sort of agenda and the discourse of this humanitarian project. For a while, it established humanitarianism as the dominant discourse in the racial policy of empire. Likewise, the control of imperial policy, of colonial policy, seemed to be in the hands of sympathetic followers, and they set about appointing like-minded men, when possible, to govern the colonies. But racial policy was not simply, at this point, a matter of sentiment and attitude. It was inextricably connected to questions of land rights and law. And in these respects, the liberal empire presents a variegated landscape. Let's take the matter of land rights first. The problem, of course, was how to settle on a policy, on a land policy, that could accommodate the interests of both native people and settlers. It's easy to assume that the dispossession of the indigenes was foreordained, but this was not necessarily so. The land issue posed different challenges in different places, and imperial history hasn't been much interested in it. What I want to emphasize here, however, is that one of the themes of land policy was an ongoing search for ways to limit and control the tendency of settler culture to seek unlimited and unbridled expansion. When the South Australian Company, for example, received permission to create a new colony in the mid-1830s, it was hedged around with all sorts of restrictions that were designed to protect Aboriginal land rights. Likewise, the issue of land title lay at the center of New Zealand politics for the first 30 years of its history as a colony. And I'm talking mainly about Australia and New Zealand here, so here's a map of the two. On the one hand, in New Zealand, there were those who wanted the state to stay out of the matter of land sales and land possession. On the other hand, there were powerful voices that demanded state regulation of all land sales, and George Grey was a leading exponent of that. This view respected Maori land title and was intended to regulate land sales that would foster amalgamation, as they called it, between the races. And until 1860, until the end of the 1860s, this struggle over the character of land policy was largely unresolved. It resolves itself concurrent only with the final defeat of Maori resistance and the completion of the process of settler control over local politics. In Australia, the claim that Aborigines had no permanent interest in the soil was known to be false almost from the moment the first fleet landed. Indeed, terra nullius does not appear in the law reports until 1836, and it was not fully established legal doctrine until 1889, at which time it came into common usage. Virtually everyone in the early 19th century who had any dealings with Aborigines recognized the complexity of the Aboriginal relationship to the land. Local colonial officials fretted quite a lot over the disjuncture between this and the fact that the land was treated by settlers as if it was there for the taking. Land tenure depended upon the law, and the law was a further foundation of liberal policy in this period. Legal sovereignty was critical to the creation of empire, but implanting legal sovereignty was not a straightforward process. English law did not come neatly packaged in the cargo holds of the immigrant ships to be trundled onto the beaches of those new worlds to shock and awe the natives with its pomp and glory. In Australia, English law was not extended over indigenous crime until the 1830s. In South Africa, Natal, this did not happen until the 1850s and 1860s. So the expansion of English law was a halting, uneven process. It did not proceed from a grand strategy. And the reason for this was that no easy answer provided itself or presented itself as to what to do with existing indigenous culture. We need to remember that empire was a continual adjustment to the realities of indigenous society. And this convergence was particularly pertinent for the law. What place within the law should be made for the customs and the law of indigenous peoples? Remember, this was before the idea took hold that there was no history nor law amongst these indigenous peoples before the colonial experience. People like Eyre and Grey knew very well indigenous law. They knew about indigenous law. But the problems were considerable. There were no simple answers how to fit the English law and indigenous law together. How was English law to be extended to Aborigines, for example, when their testimony could not be admitted into court? when they had no comprehensions of the definitions of English crime, when they didn't understand the meaning of an oath. How could justice be secured for the Aborigines, they asked, under these circumstances? These questions were the subject of considerable intellectual head scratching. And at this stage, English law had to adapt to local law and custom. Indeed, those at the frontier of empire explicitly recognized the necessity for the colonial regime to support the continued existence of native law through their own systems, even to the extent in southern Africa, for example, of the state aiding and abetting the enforcement of indigenous witchcraft law, or what was regarded as witchcraft law. So the point is that for a long time, into the 19th century, a legal pluralism marked the frontiers of empire, with different spheres of responsibility and varying a scope of coverage for the English and native legal systems. Attempts to find a way to make English law compatible with indigenous culture, however, were loaded with contradictions. I've looked at several of these efforts by Gray and others, and the narrative pattern is the same. They start from liberal humanitarian premises, how to constrain settler violence, how to treat the Aborigines with respect and restraint, and they end up inverting those premises to justify the violation of the boundaries of liberal justice. The liberal attempt to develop and create a policy that would encompass its humanitarian values quickly and continually confronted the limits of its reach. And as it reached those limits, the contradictions were exposed. And in this way, liberalism became despotism. So this leads me to ask the question, how did liberalism reach its limits? What was it that led empathy to be overtaken by indifference? I think that this question lies at the heart of understanding how liberalism worked in empire. It's a question that is sharply illuminated by individuals like Edward John Eyre and Sir George Grey. But how can we approach the subject position of men like Grey? What were the subjective interiorities that marked this transformation from benevolence to despotism? I suppose the most common response to that question would point to the inherent tendencies within liberalism itself, and these are certainly relevant. But they don't take us into the subjective experience of those at the frontier of empire. And I think that it was the experience of contact that disturbed the foundations of empathy. Contact with indigenous peoples did not result in binary emotions or responses. It was not simply a case of othering, a word I hate. We need to begin to understand the psychological dynamics of the colonial mind. Gray and Eyre were sincere in their empathy, in the empathy that they felt for the indigenous peoples they encountered in their early years. But empathy was complicated, isn't it always? Early 19th century empathy was combined with pity and reformation. It was full of pity for the savages, for the savage state, but it also required that the indigenes internalize that pity. Only then could the reforming prescriptions of the humanitarian kick into gear. The problem was that if the indigenes declined that pity and rejected the reforming program, there was no other resource. For the humanitarian, such a response revealed empathy to be empty of promise. There was a phrase that I came across several times during the South African research that I did for the book Making Empire, a phrase that struck me with the simplicity of its power and its closure. They have refused the gospel. They have refused the gospel. refusal happened in the course of direct contact with indigenous cultures. The limits of liberalism were revealed in everyday practice of policy implementation as the vision of liberal empire encountered the obstinate tenacity of indigenous culture. This encounter set in motion a dynamic that led humanitarians and liberals to adopt strategies that turned liberalism inside out, both in terms of its policies and in terms of its conception of state structures. From the beginning, indigenous culture was recognized as the biggest obstacle to the changes liberals wanted to see in native peoples. After his observations of the Aboriginal cultures of Western Australia in the late 1830s, Gray was under no illusions as to the enormity of the task confronting liberal policy as it sought to reform indigenous culture. As he was formulating his strategies in the late 30s and early 40s, he was inclined to tolerate a wide sphere of autonomy for that culture and for those traditions. He was hopeful that the combination of soft power initiatives such as education and the paternal protection of men like Eyre against the enormities of settler violence would be enough to introduce modernity into our Aboriginal culture. But he was always aware, that is Gray, that soft power might not be enough. After some years of thinking and debating with himself, he clearly came to the conclusion that more forceful action was required to cut through the cultural obstacles that indigenous society proposed to civilizing progress. I think he finally settled on this in his early years in New Zealand. And indeed, the driving force of his policy towards the Maori and the Kosa was the extinction of those restraints. Changing indigenous culture by either soft power or coercion implied another contradiction of liberalism in empire. A liberal empire demanded a thorough expansion of state power. Now, Eyre is interesting here because in this respect, he spent several years at the edge of the empire as a resident magistrate in the Murrindy district of New South Wales, where he combined the roles of missionary and magistrate. He'd been sent to Murrindy in the wake of a particularly nasty series of conflicts between drovers, settlers, and Aborigines. His job was to implement a liberal policy towards the native peoples. There's nothing particularly elaborate about this policy. It rested upon familiar foundations of paternalism, conciliation, and what Eyre called kindness. He spent 3 years at Murrindy, and to judge from his reports from the time he spent there, he spent it seriously considering the challenges of a modus vivendi between the imperial presence and Aboriginal culture. When he finished his term of office, he reported to Gray, who happened to be the governor of Australia, South Australia at that time, he reported that his policy had worked. Peace had been brought to the area. The Aboriginal peoples now trusted the imperial administration. They were beginning to participate of their own accord in the legal system, he argued. Indeed, so successful had this policy of conciliation and kindness been that there might not be a need to appoint his successor, he wrote. And this had all happened in 4 years. I should note here that wishful thinking was and is endemic to the imperial mind. But if we stay behind the evidence again, there's no reason to doubt the sincerity of this observation. So Eyre proposed that his work in Murrindy be built upon to create a tight network of government supervision to install a policy elsewhere that would reconcile the need for a respect according to Aboriginal rights and push forward the mission of imperial modernity. Eyre was not unusual in arguing this way. Imperial policy at the frontier expanded the reach of the state, whether it sponsored missionary and other reforming activity or created networks of officials like resident magistrates whose job it was to carry imperial standards of civilization and to act as the rule of law at the frontier. In liberal empire, the state's priority in this respect reveals that the state's priority was to protect indigenous cultures from the fatal impact of an unrestrained intercourse with Europeans. State power was used to regulate contact with Europeans to ensure that its benefits were transmitted rather than the corruptions of European culture. It was the state's responsibility to install appropriate mechanisms of change within native culture to provide for a gradualist assimilation into British culture. It was for this reason that Grey worked to retain a tight control over land policy in New Zealand. It was for this reason that he resisted settler pressure for a rapid expansion of Crown purchases from the Maori. To be successful, a liberal policy demanded a despotic exercise of state power and the expansion of the sphere of state control that went way beyond the traditional precepts of liberalism. Empire always turns into a vast social engineering project. The case of the protectors, for example, appointed to arbitrate relations between settlers and indigenes in this period, is but one example of the way the liberal vision of empire led ineluctably to the notion of an expanded state. And I'm delighted that Alan Lester is part of a project that is will write the history of these protectors, a long-ignored topic, but an important one. As it suggests, a powerful state flexing its liberal policy muscles through activist officials was not a threat to indigenous culture alone. The powers of the imperial state were directed towards controlling the settler community. A liberal policy needed both local state and imperial state structures to put their joint weight behind it. This was easier for the London authorities. All the time, the imperial discourse on empire was the dominant language of imperial politics. It was much harder in the colonies when the humanitarian interest was always much weaker, and where humanitarians, of course, were the subject of raucous and growing settler politics and settler power. The point is, however, that the imperial state was not the creature of settler politics. This was precisely the problem for the settlers. In the colonies, the power of imperial officialdom was under increasing pressure from settler demands for representative government. This was a demand that fitted well with metropolitan definitions of liberalism and the growing priority in British politics for a diminished colonial expenditure. The home government's commitment to a liberal policy towards indigenes had always been fragile. Humanitarianism had never been able to establish an unquestioned hegemony over the policy process or the discourse on race. And by the late 1840s, the edifice of liberal humanitarianism was crumbling. It took democracy in the form of responsible government, however, to bring the state firmly under settler control. It hardly needs to be said that this was a transition that worked to the detriment of indigenous people. By the 1850s, then, the attempts to install a liberal humanitarian-based policy of imperial rule were petering out. This was true at the frontier. It was true in metropolitan politics. It was true both from the internal and the external perspectives of liberalism itself. Liberalism internally, one can say that internally liberal subjectivities dissolved when mixed with the pervasive endurance of indigenous culture, which by the 1850s, of course, had everywhere demonstrated their resilience and their resistance to the persuasions of a humanitarian approach. What was left was coercion, a policy that previously had been adopted with much hand-wringing and as a confession of failure. After about 1850, coercion was justified as being provoked by the native peoples themselves, by their willful rejection of the benefits that were being offered them by imperial culture. Before 1850, blame for the failure of the liberal project was more likely to be attributed to the deleterious influences of low-life settler culture or the mutual incomprehension of the cultural encounter. So as policy after 1850, although you can find remnants of it within the imperial experience, as policy after 1850, as policy, it fades away. What I've proposed so far, then, is that the idea of a liberal empire during the early 19th century may be seen as a serious policy option, and that looking at it from the inside, as it were, is a useful way of understanding the dynamic between liberalism and empire. But is there anything more to this than just another lost cause of purely academic historical interest? Or is the attempt to graft liberal humanitarian policies onto imperial experience worthy of note for more long-lasting reasons? I'm not thinking so much of policy reasons, but rather whether any legacies remain from this historical moment. Well, I think there were. And I want to conclude by pulling back the perspective to suggest how we might see this moment in a longer historical theme. The first legacy was the contribution of this humanitarian discourse to authenticating and explaining empire in British culture. This is probably familiar to you, but there remains a lot to be said about how it worked historically. In the early 19th century, the moral case for empire had yet to be firmly established in political discourse. The challenge to the British civitas posed by empire was recognized and was eloquently phrased by the critique of Edmund Burke, and Edmund Burke was not speaking as a lone voice. From the start of the 19th century, however, this critique of empire was overwhelmed by the related forces of evangelical humanitarianism and liberal utilitarianism, which implanted the idea that empire was a progressive force. And from this point onwards, humanitarian discourse played a dual role. It justified empire on the grounds of liberal progress, and it provided a vocabulary of criticism for the methods of empire. Ironically, however, the discourse of liberal humanitarianism ascends to this dual role only after liberal imperial policy was removed from the palette of viable policy options by the end of the 1840s. It was from this historical moment that the conventional description of liberalism as thoroughly implicated and imbricated in empire comes to reflect and express the reality of historical experience. It was only then, from the middle of the 19th century, that liberalism with a capital L entered into an unqualified partnership with empire. The idea that Britain's empire was at root a liberal project, an idea that, of course, was not uncontested, came to occupy an unquestioned place in the discourse of empire, particularly in the era of high imperialism from the late 19th century. This idea of empire as mission morphed easily into ideas of trusteeship and responsibility that were the core justifications of empire in the 20th century and were the footings for the idea of Britain as a liberal imperial power. This was to retain a salience well beyond the period of the end of empire. For a long time, it was a foundational trope for most studies of British imperialism, and it can still be found in some quarters of the historical scholarship. So one of the legacies of the liberal empire was to help to redefine the justification of empire itself, to put it on a securer foundation than it could have expected coming out of the 18th century. But there's a second way in which the effort to create a human rights policy for empire, to inject morality into the formation of imperial policy, provided an historical legacy that is worth our attention. And it's a legacy that has meaning beyond the provincial interests of British history. The liberal humanitarianism I've been discussing may be seen as part of a much longer European discourse on the place of indigenous peoples in the system of relations between states. What were the justifications for imperial domination? What rights did indigenous peoples possess within an imperial system? These were questions that had troubled European thinkers since the early days of the Spanish Empire. It is true that the bias of international law had been tilting in favor of imperial power and against indigenous rights, at least since the Dutch lawyer Hugo Grotius penned his various treaties at the beginning of the 17th century. But this question remained more open than we tend to assume. It was not until the mid-19th century that international law finally closed the door on a place for indigenous peoples. And around the same time, in the U.S. Supreme Court and in the newly founded Supreme Courts of New South Wales and other settler colonies, law was being written, formalizing the sovereignty of colonial states over the land and peoples under their domain. In its way, then, the liberal humanitarianism of the early 19th century represented the last faint threads of a discourse and a policy tradition that went back to Las Casas, who so famously stood up for the natural rights of Indians in the early days of the Spanish Empire. But in recent years, this tradition has reared its head again. You may see it in the dramatic reintroduction into international law of arguments that indigenous peoples have rights transcending the states to which they belong, recognizing that those states often are the product of imperial intervention. In its turn, this movement has received impetus from a new militancy amongst indigenous peoples that emerged across the southern hemisphere in the last 20 years or so. This militancy is directly related to the issues that were at the heart of the policies of the liberal empire in the early 19th century, the issues of land rights and the nature and operation of the law. Across the old settler colonies of the British Empire, and in a very different form in the United States, the claim for indigenous rights, for a recognition of land rights that were disrupted and denied by colonization, have inserted themselves into the politics of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And of course, at another level, the issue of land rights in South Africa is one of the most forbidding problems that new democracy faces. The law and the land are the central issues, are the two central axes around which this indigenous rights politics revolves. Most famously, the Mabo legal case in Australia. Here is Eddie Mabo, the Torres Straits Islander. This case around his rights, access to land, injected the legacy of the 19th century into the politics of late 20th century Australia. Mabo established that conquest had not extinguished Aboriginal land rights. And in one swoop, it declared the founding myth of Australian identity as invalid. Australia before 1788, it turns out, was not a terra nullius without systems of indigenous polity or culture. The exact nature of these indigenous rights movements has varied, of course, from one settler colony to another, reflecting their very different historical trajectories. That's a subject of another paper, perhaps, which I cannot address here, but I do wish to highlight one aspect of these movements that's commonly shared across the continents and countries, and that is how the case for indigenous rights is argued through the language of the liberal enlightenment, rather than through the language of revolution. They have appealed to morality as their main political weapon and reconciliation as their main political strategy. And they have used the resources of the law to argue for their rights. On both counts, these movements, can be seen to refer back to the issues and the sentiments that animated and bedeviled the liberal empire. It is a movement that addresses the legacies of liberal empire in the language of the humanitarians. The politics of Aboriginal rights in contemporary settler society revolve around the question of how to balance state power with respect for cultural difference. But isn't this the dilemma that Grey, Sir George Grey, and Edward John Eyre, that bastard Eyre as he was known in the West Indies, and other policymakers of the Liberal Empire grappled with? May I be so foolhardy as to draw a line between the movement for the rights of Indigenous peoples and people such as Grey and Eyre? Is it so absurd to see this as one of their unintended legacies? Certainly, we can say that the failure of a liberal policy of empire is inability to transcend the limitations of its ideological precepts or the political forces arraigned against it had consequences that persist down to the present day. In 2007, in September 2007, after many years of agitation, pressure, and diplomatic maneuverings, the Indigenous Peoples' Rights Movement finally succeeded in securing a declaration of the rights of Indigenous people from the General Assembly of the United Nations. The key issues of this declaration were the issues of land rights, of access to land, of land tenure, and the protection and validation of Indigenous cultures. Of course, these issues resonated across many parts of the world. One perhaps tends to think instinctively when Indigenous rights comes up of Latin America, of countries in Latin America. But these were the issues that the humanitarians in the British Empire and in the Anglo world as a whole, actually, grappled with in their day. These were the issues that were identified by Indigenes and humanitarians alike as being at stake in the period of the early and mid-19th century. These were the contradictions of empire that the policies of the liberal empire, the policies that I've been talking about, were designed to reconcile. And there was this much of a direct line from one to the other. On September the 13th, 2007, when the vote was taken in the General Assembly of the United Nations, only four countries voted against the declaration. They were the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Now, this is not, of course, the end of the story, but it does, I think, provide an appropriate moment to close these remarks, for it's a pointed demonstration of the way the legacies of empire refuse to fade into the distant mists of academic history. Thank you.